Thanks very much, Don, for the introduction and for all the organizers for having me here. My goal is, I really have two goals. First, I want to talk, I want to present some of what I study, which I hope can be a useful object lesson that might help think about how to organize the community you want to bring together here, because it's about how physicists organized their own communities after World War II, when it was, the community was growing and diversifying. And second, I want to turn that around and talk about how physicists can contribute to the history of physics. So at the end, I have a little epilogue where I discuss some of that. To say, I'll return to this map a little bit later, but just by way of introduction, I'll say it was made by Bern Porter, who is a physicist who graduated from Colby College, where I used to teach. And this was from 1939, his representation. It's a map of physics. And I'll talk a little bit more about what I think the significance of this is a little bit later. Here is my outline. In my introduction, I will provide a little bit of the context, 1930s, 1940s context that I think is relevant. I'll move on after that to talk about, in this context, how physicists defined physics, what they thought it was, and how those definitions changed over time, so this question of identity. Then I'll hone in on the case study of the founding and growth of solid-state physics in particular, which I think has some notable features for the way it broke with tradition in the physics community. I'll give some summary reflections on what I think we can learn from this history, and then I'll give my epilogue about contributing to the history of physics. Anybody recognize this hat, by the way? Herb?
I think it's a famous cover. That's the pork pie hat of
Yeah, so this is Oppie's iconic pork pie hat. It's sitting on the 184-inch cyclotron at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory. This is the cover of the very first issue of Physics Today, May 1948. Which I show because Physics Today was a mechanism that the AIP introduced to try to deal with some of the issues people were having with the increasing diversity of American physics. It was meant to be a forum where you could speak to a general audience to fight off what John Van Fleck called the balkanization of American physics, which will be relevant to this story. So first, some of the context. What we have is some pretty rapid growth in the 30s through the 50s. So this is the one measure of that is the membership of the American Physical Society. So from 1939 over here to 1950 or so, you have about a threefold increase in the enrolled membership of the American Physical Society. So the population's going up. That's just one measure. Another measure might be articles in Physical Review. So again, raw quantitative information with some interesting dynamics behind it. So you can see it growing pretty abruptly up until 1930, 31. This is when the load started to get high enough that they created a couple new journals. So Reviews of Modern Physics was started around this time. The American Journal of Physics was started around this time to peel off some of those publications. Qualitatively, what's happening here is that the standing of the journal is changing as well. There's a nice quote from John Van Fleck where he's talking about, he got his PhD in 1922, if I recall correctly, and said he was very pleased that it was accepted for publication in a philosophical magazine in England, because Physical Review is considered a little bit of a backwater journal. The European libraries would just unbox it once a year because nobody was really interested in it. But by early 1930s, the standing of those publications had reversed. Once Jack Tate becomes editor, he is very opportunistic with respect to the quantum revolution, publishes papers very quickly, and Physical Review suddenly becomes a very important international journal. So those numbers are also showing the increase in prestige. World War II, obviously, you have publication embargoes on nuclear physics. You have physicists sequestered in places where they're not publishing much. But this very rapid growth you see after the war is an indication of some of that latent expansion that's going on in the physics community.
Sure.
Yes?
On the previous slide, why does it look like it's sigmoidal instead of exponential? Yeah, why is it plateauing?
In the 1950s, I think it's what you see here is this post-war boom of all the people who kind of had their training had diverted or coming back in, and it kind of exhausted that reservoir of potential. It still grows after that if you plot it up. But so I think this is just an unusually rapid phase right there after World War II. Yes?
Where does the GI Bill kick in?
influence on this graph?
Yeah, I imagine it would. The question is, I don't know how many of the individuals who are benefiting from the GI Bill are joining the physical society. So there are a lot of people who are probably part of that influx of students into the universities who don't necessarily go on to become active in the profession. So I don't know if it would map on closely, but it's certainly a factor. But I'd imagine, all right, so you get people coming back in the early 40s. If they're already out of undergraduate, maybe they're going right into grad school, so you'd see that probably start in that sharp upturn there is probably the beginning of it. I'd speculate, yeah.
Do you know if anybody has looked at the situation in the Soviet Union over this period of time after the war and stuff? Because they were sort of separated in the world, was it? There was lack of connection.
Yeah, there was. There's a great quote from the minutes of the Council of the American Physical Society right after Sputnik, where they said a motion to congratulate the Russian Physical Society on their successful satellite launch was tabled for lack of knowledge as to whether or not there exists a Russian Physical Society. So yeah, not far off. There are some historians of Russian physics who are starting to ask these sorts of questions. Alexei Klyebnikov, Michael Gordon. I don't have any direct knowledge of the quantitative issues, but I imagine it's probably similar. You have similar dynamics in terms of the prestige of the discipline in the Soviet Union that you do in the United States, the importance of national security, that sort of thing. So because the contexts are similar in those respects, I'd expect you'd see a similar sort of pattern. So what I want to emphasize beyond the quantitative parts is that there's also a qualitative diversification here, especially into industry and applied physics. So historically, applied physics not really considered a part of the purview of the American Physical Society. It was a pure science organization. That starts to change around mid-century, where you have an effort to get more industrial and applied physics involved in the physical society. So this is an article in the Journal of Applied Physics by Thomas Osgood, who was at Michigan State University, where he says that technical physicists have known too little about the work in which their academic colleagues are engaged, and an even more lamentable ignorance of the practical problems of the age, which are being solved by physicists in industry, have been displayed by those who train students in the rudiments of physics. So as you get this growth of industry, it's a little bit orthogonal. There's not a lot of communication. That's one of the big problems that everybody agrees needs to be addressed. And the issue of training is a big issue, because more and more jobs are in industry, more and more PhD physicists are going into industry, but their training isn't necessarily preparing them for the types of challenges they'll have to face when they get there. So everybody more or less agrees that this is a problem, but they don't agree on how to address it. So these two represent divergent ways of thinking about that problem. On the left is Carl Darrow, secretary of the Physical Society, for many decades. And he, if you ever get a chance to read the meeting minutes, he makes them hilarious. He's a fantastic writer, so he makes this history very interesting. And on your right is Henry Barton, who was the director of the AIP at the time. So AIP starts in 1931, mostly as a publishing outfit to unify all the relevant societies of physics, so it includes the AAPT and the Optical Society and the Acoustical Society, so it has a much broader view of what physics is. Darrow, the representative of the APS, wants to address this issue with industry in a certain way. There had been a couple proposals for a new division of the Physical Society devoted to industry. Darrow and the Council had shot this down on constitutional grounds, because Article 9 of the APS Constitution says if you want a division, it has to be devoted to a subject of physics. And industry, as far as they were concerned, was not a subject. So this is what he says on this question. The Council is disinclined to favor a division of industrial physics. One of the things most greatly to be desired is a unification of the physicists called academic and the physicists called industrial. A division of industrial physics would work exactly in the opposite direction. And what Darrow has in mind by unification is bringing the industrial applied elements to heel in terms of the pure science objectives of the Physical Society. Barton, at the AIP, and representatives of the AIP, take another view, which is that we should kind of expand our view of what physics is to include these applied areas. So two different views of what physics is and what its goals are. And
it's cleverly written.
Sorry?
It's extremely cleverly written because it's a play on the word division.
Yeah.
It's a bureaucratic subunit.
Right.
And all of a sudden, in the end of the sentence, it works to say this is going to divide us.
Yeah, and that you see that sort of wordplay frequently from this, from Darrow and then Fleck and those types who are saying, look, division is not what we want. We want unity. Yeah. Unity is a big word, but people mean different things by unity.
But they're the ones who make the divisions.
Yes.
It's the council that divided our subject into divisions.
They did, but they didn't do it willingly. Yeah. They didn't do it willingly. They were reluctant. So it was,
So the idea of division.
Yeah.
Okay, all right, that is fine.
It was 1931 when Article 9 was added to the Constitution. It wasn't until 1943 that you get the division of electron and ion optics, which is now atomic and molecular physics. It changed names and focuses a couple times. And then shortly after, the division of high polymer physics in 1944. So it took a while, and the council was a little bit reluctant, but they acquiesced. Okay, so this brings me to my second section here, which is about this question of definition. This is a historian of physics, Dan Kevles, who has a relatively well-known quote in the history community where he says, physics is what physicists do. Sounds kind of tautological. If you're a historian, this plays right into your insecurities, this quote, because, you know, a historian reads this and says, well, you know, of course, we're not reifying this community. Of course, you know, we recognize that this is subject to all sorts of historical contingencies. And so historians are sympathetic to Kevles, you know, when he continues and says, or have done, the history of post-war physics is to be found not only in the great accelerator laboratories, but also, and perhaps even more so, in the R&D installations of industry, such as Bell Labs and the laboratories of the federal government. So historians go along with this pretty uncomplainingly. But what's interesting to me from a historical perspective is that this is not true of physicists, right? Especially at the time. And here are a couple people who would have disagreed with that statement, physics is what physicists do. The one on your left is Henry Rowland, founding member of the APS, who wrote some articles kind of outlining what he thought was needed, what the society was supposed to do in the late 1900s, and it was about protecting a place for pure science. He was worried that the temptation of industry would move this incipient community away from pure knowledge. The other one is John Van Fleck, which you see here, his brief stay at the University of Minnesota in the 1920s, sitting next to Jack Tate, who was editor of the Physical Review. And he was infuriated with the divisionalization of the American Physical Society. He's the one who said it's being balkanized. He talks about having the Quaker spirit of the APS meetings, where you sit in the long lawn of the Bureau of Standards and you can talk about whatever comes to mind. There's a lot of talk across specialties. He very much wants to protect the society, protect the environment that he enjoys, and sees the applied physicists coming in kind of as the barbarians at the gates of Rome, right? He wants to keep them out. So I want to illustrate these views in two different ways with the maps, and this comes back to the map, where the assumption behind this representation is that this is not a map that says physics is what physicists do. Physics is what's out there in the world, and physicists are the ones who go and get it, right? So this is what this view represents. If you can represent it as a feature, a geographical feature of the landscape, then it's something that's out there. And people like Van Fleck, people like Darrow, this is the view of physics that they're cleaving to. Physics is out there in the world. Around this is 1939, Bern Porter draws this. This is another map of physics. This appears in an article in 1944 by Wallace Waterville and Elmer Hutchinson, giving the AIP view. And they call this their map of physics. And you can see a very different sort of representation here. Right? This is an organizational map. Right? You've got the American Physical Society up here that's focused on pure and fundamental research, but that's just one element of the United States of physics as they saw it. You also have the American Society for Heating and Vacuum Engineers, for instance, included in the synthesis. You have the Institute for Radio Engineers. So there's a lot of engineering societies, and you have kind of, it took me a while to notice this actually, but you have kind of this frontier out here where they're expanding and eating up more ground. This is a different view. This is physics is what physicists do. And this is giving physicists latitude to organize their activities and their discipline in ways that are convenient to the professional context at the time. And that's the important transition that I think happens after World War II. And that's what I want to talk about a little bit more. Oh, before I do that, here's another guy who espoused this view, this what I call the conventionalist view. Gaylord Probasco Harnwell was a physicist at Penn, later president of Penn, University of Pennsylvania, who says there will be more physicists after the war, but the great majority of them will have the technical or craftsman's attitude towards the science rather than the professional or academic point of view. So there's a group of people who are influential within the community, largely on the AIP side, who are saying, look, there's going to be more room for applied work in industry. We need to take advantage of that, keep it within physics. Don't let it go off and become new parts of engineering. So quick review, here are the two competing views, the two competing definitions. The naturalistic view, where it's just the empirically accessible, mathematically describable regularities in the physical world that is what physics is. And the other view that says it's the community, it's what physicists do. So I've got the famous picture of the Solvay conference there to illustrate that. So that's where we are, and that's the state of play in the 1940s when you get the emergence of this new discipline of solid-state physics. Responsible for that, largely, is this guy, Roman Smoluchowski. He was a Polish emigre and fled Central Europe in the 1930s as things were starting to get hairy. His father was Marian Smoluchowski, a famous mathematician. And he landed at General Electric. He's doing work on metals, and he's looking around and getting a sense of the context and realizes that the type of people he worked with, the type of work he does, doesn't get much traction in the physical society, and he sets about to rectify that. He sends a letter to 53, what he calls metals physicists, asking them to start a division of metals physics. And this is his, one of the things he says in this letter. It was titled, by the way, The Present War is a Physicist War. So this is during World War II, thinking about what's going to happen after the war. And he says, we can expect development of various branches of physics, pure and applied physics, and we would like them to remain branches of engineering rather than to become new pure sciences or new types of engineering. So he's very worried that what he's doing, what he's seeing at GE, what his colleagues are doing at Bell, what people are doing at Westinghouse, is going to leave physics and become a new engineering specialty, and he doesn't want that to happen. And so he wants this proposed division of metals physics to keep those people in physics, give them a home in the physical society, cater to their needs. If you think about the type of stuff that industrial researchers are doing at the time, a topical division, a narrow topical division, doesn't serve you well. You might have to work on optics 1 week, electromagnetism the next week. You have to be a little bit more of a generalist. So he honed in on metals as the common ground that would allow people that sort of flexibility. APS Council didn't like metals. They said, eh, how about solid state? And so that's why we got solid state physics. It was kind of an accident how we got that name. If you're like me, like most people, you probably have the same reaction to that as Gregory Wannier, a theorist at the University of Iowa, who said solid state physics sounds kind of funny. This was his reaction in 1943 when the name was first proposed. Solid-state physics became established pretty quickly after that, of course. And you might think that that attitude softened, but it really didn't. This is Dwight Gray. He was the editor of the American Institute of Physics Handbook, big reference work, which added a chapter on solid-state in 1962. And this is what he had to say about that. Adding solid-state to the conventionally labeled group of mechanics, heat, acoustics, and so forth is a little like trying to divide people into women, men, girls, boys, and zither players. Right? So this added to this, there was this sense in the community that solid-state was just an odd way to carve things up. And what I argue is that it was, and that's exactly what was important about it. This, if you think back to the map, right? how would you represent solid-state physics on that map? It draws from all these regions. It's using heat, it's using acoustics, thermodynamics, quantum mechanics, it's using all of that stuff. And it was an unusual way of covering up the field because it addressed professional issues rather than conceptual issues. It was a way to create a new community focused on what the professional pressures were at the time, rather than to organize a particular existing research program. And so in these quotes, you see some of that. See these physicists seizing on what was different about it. Just because it was different, though, doesn't mean it wasn't successful. So these are all the data I've been able to collect on divisional membership over time in the American Physical Society. It's kind of a mess down there. This one is Division of Solid State Physics, this purple one that goes up there. Now the Division of Condensed Matter Physics. I could talk your ear off about that name change, but we'll bracket that issue for now. A few things about the dynamics here. So this big jump you see in the late 1960s corresponds with an aggressive membership drive at APS meetings. They went around beating the drum, and you see that to a lesser extent in the other divisions. This big systematic drop is when the APS started charging for divisional membership, which understandably scared a lot of people off. Those things aside, what you see in general is that once they start this membership drive, that taps into a latent potential for people in solid state physics. There are a lot of people working in this area who felt as though this was now serving their needs, it was doing something for them. And so this growth indicates that it was successful to an extent. It did serve some of the professional needs at the time. And even if, so it's 1978, it changes its name to Division of Condensed Matter Physics and changes focus a little bit. In the time, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, it spoke to a need and was able to shape the discipline in a way that was conducive to the goals of people in a different institutional context. So I'll throw this up. Some of you might have seen this before by way of summary reflection. This is from a 1989 issue, February issue, I think, of Physics Today, paired with an article by Leo Kadanoff. If you can't read the caption, this is the older male physicist talking to his younger female colleague, saying, "I'll be working on the largest and smallest objects in the universe, superclusters and neutrinos. I'd like you to handle everything in between." Which captures a certain ideological bent in part of the physics community, right? This extremophilia. But I show this because it illustrates these prestige hierarchies that we have in physics, right? This sense that certain types of questions are more important than others. And it was those types of attitudes that drove the way that solid-state physicists tried to organize their community. They were very sensitive to what they saw as the sometimes derogatory assessments of their work by nuclear and high-energy physicists. So you might have heard the old story about Wolfgang Pauli calling solid-state physics Schmutzphysik, or physics of dirt, or of Murray Gell-Mann's statement that solid-state physics is squalid-state physics. Right? These have been perpetuated mostly by solid-state physicists themselves. That's where you hear these repeated, because it's a way of this oppositional identity formation, right? And so that had to do with galvanizing this community that for a long time otherwise had very little in common, right, within it. If you're working on the phenomenology of steel using mostly classical methods, you don't really have that much to say to somebody working on surface states and semiconductors, right? But it was part of the addressing the professional needs that made them fit together. And so I think that the important takeaway from this, and I'm a historian, so my strengths are more Epimethean than Promethean, but if this can be useful, it's to think about not just what the topical common ground is for theorists and undergraduate institutions, but what are the professional goals and how can the existing structures work to the advantage of those goals. All right, so I'll shift now to my epilogue to talk about how physicists can help history, right? And I want to point to two groups of programs. The first is at the AIP, the Center for the History of Physics, which has a lot of really fantastic history programs. By way of introduction to this topic, I will say that historians also have a kind of an R1 bias. So our dirty little secret is that we rely on scientists to write the first drafts of the history, right? We don't go and find it out for ourselves, so we just kind of rely on the stories that scientists choose to tell as our first drafts, and so that shapes how the rest of history gets done. And so I think it would be useful to have more of a sense of what's going on in undergraduate institutions brought into the history of science, and I think that there are ways that the researchers in those institutions can help. And the AIP and APS have programs that can do that. One of the, or several of the things that the AIP does, it has an oral history program. A lot of these are online. You can go and look at transcripts, read transcripts. They also have grants to conduct oral histories. They have teaching guides, so if you're looking to work history into your courses, they have a lot of great information online that you can use. Archives and records and photos. So they collect photos of physicists, basically. A lot of the photos I used in this presentation come from the Emilio Segre Visual Archives. So they collect them. You can use their little thumbnails for free. They have a nominal charge for the high resolution versions. And they have grant programs. If you'd like to conduct oral histories, if you'd like to put together an oral history program in a particular area, they have grants to help get that done. So a lot of great stuff going on at AIP history programs. The other one, which I talked about a little bit in the breakout group, is the American Physical Society Forum on the History of Physics. They do sponsored APS sessions. They have X number of slots to fill at the March and April meetings. So if ANICAP wants to partner with any of those societies, the program committee would be happy to put something together. They run a newsletter that kind of announces what's happening in history of physics, those book reviews, that sort of thing. And they have travel grants for students. So if you have a student who's working on a historical project who wants to come to APS, that's a good way to get them to APS. I'll also say, this is kind of a little known fact about history talks at the APS, they don't count against your quota. So you can come and give a history talk and give a physics talk, and you will not get in trouble. So I encourage you to participate in any either or both of these programs. And with that, I'll say thank you. Here's my contact information. I'm happy to talk about it further. And I also maintain the Twitter account for the Forum on the History of Physics. So you can follow at APS History. Thanks very much. Yes.
Hold on.
Somewhat related. So I'll start with, there's of course history of physics done neither at R1s or traditional research labs or I guess undergraduates, and that's how the hippies saved physics.
Yeah, David Kaiser.
But one of the interesting things that has some overlap with that as well is sort of development of computer science. And so I'm just wondering, are the issues with solid state physics somewhat related to computer science, or is there, you know, do you have anything to say about that?
I think you could find some similarities, right? Because, a lot of people will say computer science still isn't a discipline. That it was a label that's been kind of slapped on to organize a bunch of activities. And so in that sense, I think it's closer to material science than to solid state physics. Which formed when you had ARPA basically coming into a bunch of universities and saying, if you put all your people who are working on materials into this building, we'll give you a lot of money. And whatever that is, we're going to call material science. I have quotes where they say essentially that. this is a big experiment. What happens here, we're going to call material science because we have these strategic bottlenecks. Nanotechnology is another one where you get that sort of top-down imposition. So I think it is pretty similar to that. And was there another question that I missed?
What is just sort of the other end of the ground up,
the hippies saving physics?
Sorry.
That wasn't imposed by any organization. That sort of was an organic
set
of people coming together outside of their, day job comfort zone.
Yeah, so I don't want to oversell necessarily the top-down aspect of solid-state physics, because you do, of course, have the normal processes of people coalescing around research groups happening within that. And that's what you see as you move into condensed matter, right? Is that the field had been, there were certain groups that rose to dominance, such as people working on semiconductors, people working on NMR, the helium people. And what they wanted to do with condensed matter was to distance themselves from this industrial legacy of solid-state physics and say, well, look, this is a way to emphasize the suite of techniques that are common across phases of matter. And that emphasizes the intellectual contribution, the difficulty of dealing with these systems with many degrees of freedom. So there are some bottom-up effects there as well. I had a hand over here. Thank
you. You just answered it. You said you could speak for days about the difference between the switch from solid state to condensed matter. I wanted a few minutes, please.
Yeah, well, I can say a little more. It starts in the 1960s or so. What's interesting about condensed matter is that it's a term that's floating around before, mostly in the high-energy community, where they're talking about condensed matter as a medium, because it doesn't really matter if it's solid or liquid, if you're doing muon detection or something like that. So it's a term that's floating around. It gets slapped on the title of a journal in Germany in 1963 called Physics of Condensed Matter in English. It has equivalent titles in German and French that eventually gets absorbed into Zeitschrift für Physik. And the popular lore is that Phil Anderson coined the term with Volker Hine at Cambridge in 1968 when he was a visiting scholar, and because they changed the group there to theory of condensed matter. And that was probably important, but it definitely wasn't the origin, because you see it percolating before that. And APS is actually behind the curve in changing the name. By 1978, it's already in common parlance among some groups, but the organization was a little bit more entrenched by that point, so it was harder to move it along.
To you're portraying the history of solid-state physics as something coming out of the physics community. I'm vaguely aware that there was a discipline called metallurgy before that, and I sometimes see that treated as a predecessor of solid-state physics. Was there a continuity between the two communities, or did the metallurgy discipline die off and physicists occupied their ecological niche?
A little bit of both. There is a lot of continuity. So the one case study I'm familiar with in detail is of MIT, where Francis Bitter comes in the 1930s into the Department of Mining and Metallurgy. And he is very concerned that metallurgy is not a fundamental science and really wants to make it a fundamental science and outlines all sorts of changes to do that and promotes greater connection with physics and chemistry. And then World War II happens, and when he comes back, he gets absorbed into the physics department and is now doing the same thing for solid-state physics. So a lot of the people in metallurgy who were concerned with so-called fundamental questions got diverted into solid-state physics, and others went out into engineering. But yeah, in the 40s, metallurgy was a going concern. There was a lot of talk about it. It was a strong community. And that momentum kind of got diverted into other directions. So there's a little bit of continuity and a little bit of breaking off that's going on. Herb?
Is there a connection between the sort of adoption of condensed matter as a name and Phil Anderson's victory over the superconducting supercollider? Was it part of a move that helped him get Congress to make the mistake of picking one site too early?
Yeah. So first of all, I'd say that the type of testimony that Anderson and Nico Bloomberg and others of that ilk gave was a contributing but minor factor to the demise of the SSC. It was radically overdetermined. There were internal management. There were internal management issues. There was the decision to cut out international collaboration. There were issues with assignment. There were a whole host of things that went wrong. What's interesting about Anderson's testimony in particular is that he's really trying to strike a very delicate balance. So he's an advocate of condensed matter because he thinks it emphasizes the intellectual contributions of condensed matter physics. So that's how he wants to justify his field. He's saying, look, we're just as fundamental as what's going on in high energy physics. And it also so happens, just by coincidence, not because we're trying to, it just so happens that we're also more relevant to technology. What he doesn't want to say, what would have been the easy thing to say, is look at all the great things we've done for technology. But he doesn't want programmed research. He wants condensed matter to have a slice of the basic research pie. So in that sense, his testimony is actually unsuccessful, because it's not as though condensed matter gets this huge chunk of basic research funding that they can then do whatever they want with. They're still kind of tied to these deliverables that are coming from the military funders. So it's an interesting and a delicate sort of rhetorical dance he tries to do in these hearings. And he's successful in communicating to his colleagues. I'm not sure if it comes through to Congress. They just hear the technology part and say, now I can oppose this without being anti-science, without appearing to be anti-science. I think that's mostly the effect that it had. Yes.
I just want you to comment maybe on the Division of Fluid Dynamics, which is one of the older divisions, and that seems like a natural separation from solid state. But then when they change to condensed matter, you can make the case that some of the areas that would be covered by fluid dynamics would fall under condensed matter. And did that change in name, change how the topics divided?
They were annoyed, yeah. The DFD folks were annoyed by the change. They're saying, oh, look, we've been doing this for however many years. And so if you look at the vote, it was actually contentious. The first time they put up the name change, it got shot down because of the strong opposition from the fluid dynamics people. And the second time it went through, the vote was, I think, 15-9 in favor. And at this period in the council, most votes were unanimous. So it was pretty contentious. They had concerns that I don't think were realized. So what I don't think has happened is that the fluid dynamics territory got usurped, which is what they were worried about. So I don't think that ultimately happened, but they were worried about it at the time, and it did hold up the transition in the name. Yes?
Can you go back to the different division graph, just so I can see the different divisions?
The messy chart.
No, yeah. Yours, right. Where'd it go?
There we are.
Yeah, okay, so when I look at this list, to me, these are still things that are out there, like in the map, like, you know, electricity, and, mm-hmm. and these are still-
Most of them.
I could imagine a completely different organization that was on methods, where you'd have like the division of field theory, you'd have like the division of Monte Carlo methods, and like we didn't do that, and we kind of don't do that, and people, that's one of the things people lament, is like, how do I find colleagues, you know, in condensed matter versus high energy that are really doing the same field theory, like we don't talk to each other, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, there's some of that. So you got computational.
Yeah.
And materials, right? That's one of those things. But there's some, there's an interesting trajectory, I think, that you can trace through this division, the atomic and molecular division. So that starts as the division of electron and ion optics. It was electron microscopists who started that division. And it changed names two or three times before it became atomic and molecular. And with it, kind of the composition of the community it was serving. And so I think that shows an evolution from this immediate post-war context where there really is a focus on getting these different types of communities represented and giving them a foothold in the physical society. So this was a group of instrumentalists who felt they needed to protect their interests. Once those interests became more secure, you saw a drift back towards the more, quote, traditional way of organizing the field. So it was around common conceptual ground rather than shared professional interests, would be my read on that. Yeah, Sharon.
First of all, getting their PhDs in Europe as opposed to the United States, and what proportion of people are joining the societies in Europe as opposed to the U.S. U.S.-based scientists is what I'm asking about.
Yeah, so that changes. In the early 20th century, it is a very large proportion who are going over to Europe. So Van Fleck, for instance, was among the first generations of theorists to be trained in the United States, and he feels very strongly about this, that he has to uphold the identity of the community as a result of that. He and John Slater, in particular, worked with Edwin Kemble at Harvard. By this time, by the period I'm interested in, it's prohibitively domestically trained people. There are some interesting dynamics about the communities in Europe. So this phenomena of solid state is this catch-all category that includes all sorts of stuff that's not really related, is very much an American phenomenon. If you look at what people are doing in Europe under the heading of solid state, it's quantum mechanics and solids with regular crystal lattices. It's a much more focused sort of enterprise. And I think that has to do with the distinctive professional conditions in the US at the time. I don't have exact numbers, though, about where the PhDs are coming from and how many of them are foreign.
I have a question. On the graph here, one of the divisions has a spike around 2004, it looks like. And I was wondering which one that was, because I can't
think
see
of
the
that
difference.
Is,
and,
I think
and
that's
why
fluid
that
dynamics. This one?
Yeah.
I think that's fluid dynamics, and I don't know why that is. That's one of the interesting things. Sorry, go ahead.
Could it be AMO? Because of the...
I don't think so. That's kind of a... This is a bad... I think this is atomic and molecular. That one right there. Yeah, sorry, this is a bad visualization of the rest of it, because I normally use it just to talk about the one that's easy to see.
I think there's a rule about number of members that you can fall below and still be a division, and fluid dynamics was really close to losing that, and there was a big membership push to bring them up. So
status. Oh, excellent. That's good to know. Yeah. What happens in other points is that divisions kind of eat topical groups and things like that. So that happened with solid state in the 60s, where they absorbed low temperature. And so that was part of this big bump, is they get the low temperature people.
And the second big rise was high temperature superconductivity, I imagine?
I think that's a confluence of factors. I think that's when they shift to condensed matter. So the identity becomes a little bit clearer, and I think that helps. Also, in this era, you could be a member of more than one division for free. And so that, I think what that is reflecting is that there were a lot of people whose primary allegiance might have been to materials or might have been to chemical physics, who said, I'm going to join this division too because they do some stuff that I'm also interested in. And so I think it had a high proportion of low commitment members during that time.
I have a question. You mentioned there was a friction between condensed matter physicists and high energy theoretical particle physicists for a long period of time, but at some point in history, there was some synthesis of ideas or flow of ideas.
Sure.
Like two things that come to my mind is spontaneous symmetry breaking or normalization group flow. From a historical point of view, like can you make a few comments of how that synthesis came about?
I think that was there were a couple of research areas where there was this. There were moments when lines of research that had previously been separate came together in ways that were fruitful. So symmetry breaking is one of those. There's an argument that Anderson could have gotten the Nobel Prize for the Higgs mechanism, for instance, right? And one of the theories of why he didn't is because of his opposition to the SSC, which, you know, understandably made him unpopular in some high energy physics quarters. My tendency is to try to turn that question around and to say, well, conceptually, there should be a lot of these crossovers. Why weren't there more of them? That's kind of my way of looking at it, that there seems to be a lot of, when you're talking about symmetries, for instance, you're going to see it in different contexts. And I think that there are a lot of institutional reasons why there wasn't more contact. There was a decision in the 1960s to focus on higher energy accelerators rather than higher intensity accelerators, for instance. And that probably closed off conversations about phenomena that you're going to see in condensed matter and in higher energy. So that's a bit of a dodge to your question, but yes.
So we have these two models, right? Physics is what physicists do, and physics is about this real stuff out there, and that's defined the categories. And I think about the group that we have here, and it's maybe about a slightly different model, that we're thinking of physics as being defined by how we do it, the context in which we do it, as the deciding thing, not necessarily what we're doing. You know, are we computational, are we whatever that categories you might have there, and not necessarily what's out there, is it atoms, is it nuclei, but some other kind of definition that's trying to draw us together. Do you have any thoughts on that as a, whether that really is a distinct model of thinking about what physics is and historically what we might learn from past experience, or I don't know, somewhat ill-formed, but is there something there that you can make better formed perhaps?
I think that you could, if you think broadly about it, you could fit that within the what physicists do sort of way of thinking. So to give some context for that argument, when Kevlis is writing that article, he's responding to Paul Foreman's claim in this article he wrote called Behind Quantum Electronics, where his argument is there's this huge influx of military funding into physics during the Cold War, and that changes the definition of basic research so that everything is inflected by this implied military sort of attitude. And so Kevlis is saying, well, look, you're proceeding from an assumption that there is a Platonic ideal of physics that we diverted from during the war. And says, no, that's not it. It's a contingent definition that's based on what the community says it is. And so I think he would group it within that position, within that way of thinking. But I think you're right to distinguish between physics is organized around these types of professional activities and physics is organized around techniques, styles of research, that sort of thing, which is a somewhat different way of forming a community than to say, hey, we all have the shared problem with the larger world, let's team up and have, I wanted to say common enemy, but that's not really it, but common challenges, common problems. Is that helpful?
Sorry.
Yeah. Yes.
Why is it that the more applied branches of physics, like solid state, have sort of hidden themselves from the public? Because I think something we all face dealing with undergrads is this dilemma where someone comes to us and says, well, I find physics interesting. We can learn about black holes and God particles. But my parents are worried that I won't be able to find a job. So we say, oh, but there are all these applied things you can do in physics, and we can bring out things from our own research. And then we schedule a seminar on solid-state physics, and nobody shows up. And the following week, we schedule a seminar on black holes, and everyone shows up. So it's this dilemma that everybody says, well, I won't major in this unless I know I can get a job, but I won't be interested in this unless it's really pure and esoteric. So why, do you have any thoughts on why, and some of that is probably human psychology, but some of that is definitely that I don't think the public knows what a solid state physicist is the way they think they know what a particle physicist is. So why didn't the solid state physicists and the quantum electronics people and whoever else reveal themselves to the public?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I have some thoughts about this. I mean, I recognize exactly what you're talking about. I went to the Festschrift for Leo Kadanoff, where a bunch of his students came back, and I remember sitting there thinking, it has so many hooks into all sorts of things that are relevant and that really anybody can grasp if they think about it. I'm like, geez, if this is what the public had in mind as their image of physics, then there wouldn't be this problem with public approbation, right? It would be an easier sell. So I think that historically speaking, when you, coming out of World War II, the people who went into high energy physics, who are the ones who ended up with the political clout, got that on the basis of their contributions to the Manhattan Project. At the same time, a lot of those same individuals were extremely disillusioned with war work. So I'm thinking about people like Robert Wilson, who like famously gets up before Congress and says that Fermilab has nothing to do with defending the country except to make it worth defending. Right, who says, I don't want anything to do with the military thing. And so that leads them into this kind of reductionist picture of the world where it's about the finding the fundamental knowledge that's valuable in and of itself as a form of culture. And so I think there's some historically contingent reasons why it was that community who was in the positions of influence, who were being interviewed in the press, had the ear of the presidents, who became the shibboleths for American physics during that period. And because the solid state people were defining themselves in opposition to that, they kind of looked down upon that sort of what they would think of as grandstanding. There are also some personality issues. So if there's a guy who could have done it for solid state, it's John Bardeen, right? The winner of two Nobel Prizes in 16 years, but he's, you know, famously laconic and that just wasn't the guy who was going to do that. So there's some personality issues, but it's a complex question, I think, with a lot of types of answers that you could give. Yes.
So then, what is the?
So what is your opinion then about why cosmology became so popular in pop culture?
That one, I think, we can give a first-order explanation on the by appealing to human psychology. right? These big questions about how the universe started. I mean, that's something that a 5-year-old can understand and that is kind of deeply captivating. So that's maybe a little unsatisfying, but I think that, you know, every kid goes through that, you know, phase where they learn about the stars and constellations and has kind of this hook into it. Now, I mean, the obvious, as I'm talking, I get the obvious counterexample is that you could have the same thing with magnets, right? There's no reason you couldn't do that. But I think there's something deep about hooking into questions about origins and telling these very grand narratives that makes a story captivating, and it's easy to do that with the universe and harder to do that with magnets, probably. Following up on this point?
Yeah, no, following up on the point on Mardine, because it seems like
the argument, he's not a popular figure, but Feynman is, and Feynman was probably one of his biggest competitors on
superconductivity.
And some of Feynman's greatest work is on vortices in liquid helium, and yet that's not what Feynman is, famous for in the public. So I think it's not just the figures, not just the human people, but something else about the topics. So I'm not sure the argument about Bardeen works.
I would absolutely say it's not just the people, but I think that's a component of a complex, multifactor explanation. Kind of another anecdote on that point, there's a great review by Wolfgang Pauli of a textbook by Born and Jordan, Elementary Quantum Mechanics, where they publish it with the old matrix mechanics right as Schrödinger is publishing wave mechanics. And Pauli writes this scathing review of the textbook, where one of the things he says is, I forget the exact topic he's talking about, but he rips apart their treatment of it and says, this has also been discussed by Pauli. Here, therefore, one cannot reproach the reviewer that he finds the grapes sour because they hang too high for him. and so I think you might see something similar happening with Feynman, that his own perceptions of his most important contributions would be the stuff in quantum chromodynamics and not the stuff on vortices, for instance. And so is his own attitude towards what the useful stuff was. And that review, by the way, you might have heard the last line, the only nice thing he says about the book, the production of the book in terms of print and paper is excellent. Tears it to shreds. That's the last line of the review.
So, I just have a...
Done.
So on this question also of fields and popular image, and this is not me the question for you, but it'd be interesting to see how it plays out in other countries and in other cultures, right? Because if it is really, right, the Manhattan Project is one of the dominant influences, and that's going to play out differently elsewhere. And I don't know if that may not be anything you need to say about, but.
A little bit. So this is an area where I'd like to develop this project more. One nice case study where I think we can see pretty clearly how national context has an effect on these sorts of developments is France, where a lot of this stuff gets disciplinized as solid-state chemistry instead of solid-state physics because of the national tradition of excellence in chemistry. That's where a lot of the people who are interested in these things gravitate. And so France is a little bit out of sync with the rest of the European and North American community in solid-state physics because they have such a strong tradition in chemistry. So one example of how that can have an effect. I know there are some hands over here. I think Sharon, you want to take it?
Were you going to add to that same thing?
I was just going to add quickly to the Feynman comment. I don't think the public is so familiar with Feynman for either liquid helium or QED. They're familiar with Feynman for lock picking.
for being a scamp.
Artwork that could get us in trouble at work these days and various other things that he did. And if Feynman had chosen to identify himself to the public as the lock picker who also does helium vortices instead of the lock picker who also does QED, then who knows what the public would think about condensed matter physics right now.
So I'm thinking about this, I don't know if it's a dichotomy, but the distinguishing physics is what physicists do, sort of that kind of social construction, which versus the more physics is out there, with a, sort of a third way, and maybe this is coming from my more mathier bend, which wants me to almost think of physics as an aesthetic, or physics is how what we believe, or what we, you know, some other kind of mental construction, right? Like when I talk to physicists often like unified theories, you know, like we like reductionism, like we have a set of values by which we evaluate claims and the beauty of theories and things like that. So I'm not saying that's necessarily, I don't know how productive that is in an idea, but there's something that's missing in that, and what it's missing is there are, I wonder what mathematicians would do. Like I can play that game with biologists and it doesn't change, right? I could say biology is what biologists do, or biologists, it's studying of living organisms, and you could see that. But I can't do that with mathematicians, because I don't think that mathematicians, well, I mean, some of them are Platonists and are going to look out there and be like, I'm discovering the country. But there's also constructivist mathematicians, and so...
Isn't that the same dichotomy?
Maybe.
There's a quote from Stephen Koonin, and I think it goes, physics is not just a discipline, it's an attitude.
Yeah, so I think there's something to the style of research, right? And I think this is... I see that sort of attitude in the way that physicists self-identify in their correspondence, for instance. They're trying to explain the difference between a physicist and a chemist, for instance. It's all about the style of research and the type of explanations that you give. And so I think that is very much how they think about their work. I think these two ways of thinking about it, which are not by any means the only ways to think about it, were the two most important in forming the institutions.
Could you tell us anything about the history of how the wider science community went from the Department of Natural Philosophy to all of these subfields of chemistry, physics, biology, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, that's a big question, right? So in some way, there are some ways in which, and this is a little bit tendentious, right? There are some ways in which I think it didn't. There are some ways in which I think physicists are still doing natural philosophy. And so I think about this in terms of the type of fights that Phil Anderson and Steven Weinberg are having in the context of the SSC over reduction and emergence. Right? Those are not questions that are going to be arbitrated by experiment. Those are questions of philosophical disposition. They're really natural philosophical questions. There's a kind of inevitable process of specialization that goes on with the growth of knowledge. That's part of it. There's also the community size thing. So you could look at what I think is called Deem theory, right? They'll look at the size of human groups that can reasonably be organized around a single principle. So as the population gets bigger, it's going to break up into smaller units with their own different inflections. So those are some of the things that I think are contributing. Yes. Sharon, you've been waiting for a while.
Just a comment about that. Part of the answer has to do with getting employed as a scientist. And that kind of employment begins, many people have argued, around the 1830, 1845, and also the massive change in universities with industrialism.
I'm just curious, did you look into how the funding agencies, for example, I'm thinking of NSF, kind of follows these classifications, because there are kind of some weird cases, like for example, for us in condensed matter theory, we are part of division of materials research, but if you're experimentalist in condensed matter, then you are in division of condensed matter. So I'm just curious, have you looked into this?
I haven't looked into the division of the NSF specifically, but I'd like to, because I think that's an important way in which these categories were reinforced and normalized. So I'd love to see more about that. I have looked a little bit at how it happened in the military agencies, so the Navy's OSR, Office of Scientific Research, is relying pretty early on a relatively small group of consultants who are imposing what their own sense of how it should be is on their funding divisions and that sort of thing. So it was in some sense dependent on who they chose to be on the panels to determine how to split up the funding.
I have one more question, but I've spoken a lot. There are other questions. Oh, Erin.
I was wondering that for some people who have lived through history, they know all these great stories. So for those of us who came later and didn't realize history was important until not that long ago, how do we?
I was hoping you were going to say right now.
How do we learn about?
Half an hour ago.
Yes, it all became clear. How do we learn more about history of physics?
Talk to us. Right?
A useful book?
There are many useful books. How the Hippies Saved Physics is an excellent one. It depends on the specific topic that you're interested in. I can't think of one general book on the history of physics that's going to cover it in a way that's satisfactory while still being interesting. But
Richard Rowe's books on
Making the Atomic Bomb are very good. They're great. They're very readable, too. Fluid prose and is good about the technical details and also about the details of the lives of the individuals involved. Those are very good on the atomic bomb. If you're interested in the growth of quantum mechanics, Helga Krog's Quantum Generations is an excellent source. And also come to history sessions at the APS. That's another one I'd say.
Sort of related question. History of physics is not very much taught in universities in a physics curriculum. Should it be? And how, what does it teach us about new insights,
I think it should be, yeah. So there's a long tradition of showing how inadequate the textbook histories of physics are. We have somebody in the audience who's contributed an important component to that. If you read Sharon Trawick's book, which was distributed, she has an excellent bit that talks about the way in which certain community values are reinforced by this pat presentation of the textbook history. And so I think let me back up there. When you break down a lot of these myths about how physics is done, about how you have sort of the great man narratives and the landmark accomplishments and the very linear progression, you get a much more detailed sense of the practice of physics. And so I think one of the things people are worried about in physics pedagogy, right, is that you've got 6-7 years of just solving well-posed problems before you get to thinking about how to pose a research question, how to conduct a study. And so I think looking at history in all its messiness is a way to give students a sense of what the process of physics is like when they're still developing the tool set they need to be able to form those questions. So that's one role where I think it can have a constructive place in physics pedagogy and teaching physics students.
Other questions?
Thank you. I could just add that comment since, for example, at UCLA we have I think it's 5 of us teaching some version of history of physics, and there's also a center for the history of physics in the physics department, and that there's not much interaction. And I happen to study that miscommunication. And I would just say that a lot of the physicists I've talked with informally say, we don't want the students learning about mistakes, and you historians pay too much attention to the mistakes.
Yes.
I tell students quite the opposite.
You need to learn the mistakes.
So one comment I wanted to make, and maybe this is for future discussion, one of the issues that we've talked about here is the whole question of locus dependence. Does it matter where we do our physics? Is it different doing physics at a PUI and at an R1? But I'm struck by the fact that some of the dialogue about should solid-state physics be allowed within the APS and so forth back in the late 40s was about that locus dependence. Oh, we're the academics. We can't have this industrial physics because when you're in industry, it's something. So be curious, it'd be interested just to think about that issue of distinguishing the physics by its locus, both negatively and positively. So
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that angle, but that's a very good one, right? So thinking about what the distinctive features are of the context of conducting theory in, in an undergraduate institution can help.
And now which I think with...
Yeah.
Well, the parallel is that they might be... Thank you.
The parallel is that those guys were going to turn into craftsmen and tradespeople, or whatever your quote said, sneaking into the professional association. And if we got to do theoretical physics, it would be teachers, educators.
Yeah, there's a nice analogy there. There's a lot of this boundary work going on in the professional societies.
I think we are out of public questions, but I'm sure there are more conversations we'll want to have with Joe, but why don't we thank Joe again.
Thanks very much.